This episode is sponsored by Vera. The world needs more data superheroes. Vera empowers you to be a data superhero with superhuman abilities to work data in a way that is faster, easier, and more fun than what you're doing today. It's the easiest self-serve data prep for accessing, transforming, analyzing, and sharing. And it just got better with the introduction of Vera 5.0. Vera 5.0 makes it easier than ever to defeat the villains in your data prep process and realize your inner data superhero with a redesigned user experience, new functional nodes, and faster technology. You know the challenges. 80% of your work along the way is fighting data in multiple places and in different formats. Then there's cleaning and deduping and transforming the data for analysis. Vera helps you with all of that kind of stuff. Make sure you check out the very cool The World Needs More Data Superheroes video trailer on getvera.com and give them a shout out for your very own trial or personalized demo. Welcome back to your favorite podcast about data, data science, and general geekery. We are here. It is me and Vidya. We are hosting another episode.
Yes,
it's very true. Before we do anything else, Vid, what are you drinking?
I am drinking champagne.
Oh, man.
Yes, because it's summertime, and for all those people that have had a rough winter, they know that this summer, like the beginning of summery, wonderful, warm days means celebration time. So we've just been drinking pretty much like champagne just to celebrate. And I'm drinking,
always celebrating.
Well, I mean, for the last like 3 days, it's been lots of drinking champagne. So I don't know why. I think it's just because really everyone's just happy that it's like winter's over for finally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm drinking a Blanc de Blanc sparkling. I guess it's not officially champagne. I don't know. There's all these rules. But it's from Argyle, it's an Argyle 2011. Not that anybody cares because it's too snobby to tell you the date.
That's pretty snobby.
I know, I couldn't help it, but it's a good one and it's delicious and it's sparkling and yay, summer.
That's nice. I am similarly drinking the champagne of caffeine, and by that I mean coffee without any milk in it.
I think the champagne of coffee can't be, it's got to be like an espresso that's like made by models or something.
What?
I mean, it's gotta be. I'm just trying to like elevate the coffee experience
because it's made by models.
Well, I don't know. I just like randomly came up with something like beautiful people making you coffee. I don't know. How can you get better? There's just such a gap between champagne and coffee that I'm like trying to add all sorts of things in there.
No, isn't that where you like put a stick of butter into your coffee? That's what makes coffee better.
Bulletproof.
Bulletproof coffee. I've never had that, but I've heard. That's what happens.
How is your coffee? And how is your daytime non-drinking?
My daytime non-drinking is sad. And my coffee's okay. You know what it is? Like, I think I really like watered down iced coffee. How bad as that sounds? Because then you get like what I really want is just something to distract me. Like I code for a while and then I need a break. Mm. I need to like do something for 5 minutes and I can't just be constantly drinking coffee because like that's going to be insane. So I need like something a little more, I don't know, like something, just something to do, like with
Why
my
don't
hands.
You get into tea.
I do drink.
For
I
tea.
No, I drink a huge amount. I drink a huge amount of tea. Huh. Not okay. All the listeners should know that when I say tea, I mean like the Lipton tea. And when Vid says tea, her place is basically like a fucking tea vendor. Like there's like 1,000 types of tea, and there's expensive tea, and there's like the regular tea but only celebratory tea, and right. Like they're very, it is a very nuanced thing, Vid's tea, which is
it helps
not the same
me
as
me. Get lots of different breaks, so you could be like, oh, what am I in the mood for? It could be a very Portland experience for you.
You
could be
definitely have like a wine cellar of tea.
I do, so just consider maybe next time you skip the Lipton.
like a $50 tea bag.
Well, you could just slowly upgrade. It doesn't have to be $50, but
no. All right. Okay.
We have a show. I think we're doing right now.
Somewhere along the lines.
Sorry, guys. This is what happens when you're drinking champagne.
All right. First story is mine. So actually, this isn't really a story. It's actually a blog post made by Elite Data Science, which appears to be like a 1 week data science boot camp of some sort. So like, this isn't like a crypto promotional thing. Like, I actually have never heard of these people, but I stumbled upon this article called 9 Mistakes to Avoid When Starting Your Data Science Career, because we're just gonna, you know, we're gonna look at it from like, if these were good or bad.
Oh, fun. Okay, I'm into it.
This is number one. Okay, this is their thing. Number one, mistake: spending too much time on theory. Many beginners fall into the trap of spending too much time on theory, whether it's math related, like linear algebra, statistics, etc., or machine learning related, like algorithms, derivatives, derivations, etc. So,
Too much time exactly?
Well, this is my thing. This is where it comes down, is that when I started learning data science, I don't think I had the strongest math background. Like, I think I was actually below what you would need to know. Mm-hmm. to work on this kind of stuff. And so what I did was go back and read some pretty basic math books to kind of ramp up my skill. And so when the people say things like, well, don't spend too much time on theory and instead work on code and that kind of stuff, one, like, the theory part is really important, because you can actually sit down and understand what's happening. Like, you don't need to master it, but like, at least you can kind of understand, like, oh, like, for example, the word, you know, matrix decomposition is put in there. And you don't need to be like on an expert on every single part of it, but at least you can sort of say, hey, I know what that is. I kind of get what's happening.
I think you should know it. I just wonder what too much time is. Like, maybe they're talking about people who are just jumping off the deep end in it somehow.
Maybe. I could see that. I think for me, it seems like the easy part is sort of like implementing it in code, and the hard part is like understanding which one to use and that kind of stuff. And this is my other thing, is that really the part of data science that's hardest is getting a job. Like, once you get a job, you're good. So like, but when you do, you know, like, a lot of interviews are theoretical. Like, yes, there's coding interviews, but like, you are way more likely to get a question like, I don't know, explain like logistic regression than you are some really nuanced question about a Python package or something like that.
Right.
So I'll say whatever, you know, do more code.
I think that you actually should get into theory. And I say this from the perspective of me not coding, because it helps me to understand what people are, like, how they're thinking through it. And we can actually have a reasonable dialogue about, like, oh, is this a good approach versus something else being a good approach? And so then you're having the discussion on approach, not so much on execution, but like the strategy of one aspect versus another. And I maybe there's definitely a line there. Like, you don't want to get so deeply into one of those things that you kind of miss out on other parts or other theories even. So there's got to be a line there. But I think it's good. I think some theory foundation is important.
Yeah, and I think we're both coming from a perspective of people who work in data in industry. So this advice probably doesn't apply if you're going for a PhD in machine learning. Like, you should probably, that's probably what you do is theory. But on a general level, yeah, you should spend some time on theory. Okay, their error number two, coding too many algorithms from scratch, which is their argument that, you know, when you shouldn't sit down and code everything from scratch, you should sort of learn how to implement it using the library, which I agree with. I think that's totally fine. Like, in fact, coding things from scratch, there's all these nuances of trying to code it from scratch, which make it really, really frustrating. Where if you sort of know generally how it works and you could probably describe it, you know, to someone in 5 minutes, just go ahead and use the use the tools, because when you're given like a coding challenge or something like that, you're not going to implement anything from scratch. And those packages have been super optimized to do things correctly. And there's no reason to go like crazy deep on coding that thing. Like, not only do you know the theory, also you've made it by hand. Oh, that's tough. I mean, something, sure, but like, that's a pretty deep wall.
I mean, it's like classic reinventing the wheel. I feel like all programmers and software developers, and I was one, so I'm not just talking shit, but I feel like it's like an art of copying.
You know? Yeah, no,
like,
totally.
Art of stealing other people's work, but like, that's what the whole system is built on. So I think it is silly, but you know, there might be something to it. If there's something that you're trying to like hack it or try to figure out how something works, I think doing it from scratch is one of the best ways of learning how things work.
Oh, yeah. Like, making it, I agree that, like, understanding those little details, but, like, man, it is a super, super lengthy process to anyone.
And, you know, that way you're not so far away from why you're using that algorithm. I can see people getting so sucked into, like, coding it or the questions that pop up, and then you're kind of distracted on, like, other things that it might be relying on, and then you're like, wait, why am I doing this again? So yeah. I think it's important to remember that you're part of a team and you're trying to solve a real-world human problem, hopefully.
Absolutely. Okay, here's their mistake number three. So they say the mistake is jumping into the deep end. Some people enter this field because they want to build technologies for the future, self-driving cars, advanced robotics, computer vision, and so on. These are powered by techniques such as deep learning and natural language processing, but you should focus on the fundamentals, which I totally, totally agree with. I've absolutely had the experience where, you know, 90% of the things that you're going to be doing in machine learning aren't actually some deep learning intense mega thing. Mm-hmm. It's something where, say, you want to do a random forest. You spent like a huge amount of time pre-processing the data to get everything in line just because it's massively messy. And then you run a very cool and obvious and well put together random forest and you get out results. And that's what the business needs in that moment. Now, if you have like a whole startup that's based on a self-driving car that needs a neural network, like, man, you should probably know how to do that stuff. But that's not right. Always the case. There's a lot of I think they call them shallow learning, like just sort of like quick, pretty quick, like machine learning techniques that are really well put together in things like scikit-learn, where you can just do them really fast. And they take time to do, but like it's not crazy for you to understand that kind of stuff. And that's going to be your bread and butter. Like your bread and butter, if you're working in Python and doing machine learning, is going to be scikit-learn and not, you know, TensorFlow or something.
Mm-hmm. And again, this is for students, right? So this is people who are not sure about maybe where they're gonna go deeper. So just get a buffet of things and figure it out later.
Yeah, no, that goes the thing. I don't think this applies to someone who has, you know, going for like a PhD in machine mm-hmm. learning or something like that. Like that, right. You're probably gonna be doing deep learning or self-driving cars or something like that. Number four, having too much technical jargon on the resume.
I love this.
I guess. I mean, I don't. I'm not sure what they're asking for, especially if you're applying to. I guess I get that, right? You have some kind of, you know, you have your resume, but you want to focus your resume on what you can provide them, rather than like, I know this library, and I know how to do random forests, and I know how to do logistic regression, stuff like that. Rather than like, oh no, I totally understand the business aspect of this. I can work well with others and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, because regardless of whether you're joining a startup or a more established, bigger company, it's not always going to be like the super deep technical people on the team that are going to have their hands on your resume. There'll be other people. There'll be business people. There'll be marketing people. There'll be who knows who. So you want to be able to communicate something about yourself to them too. And so using normal language and not kind of relying on your code chops in the resume is really helpful, especially when you're scanning. Like if I've scanned a resume from an entry level person and it's like tons of technical stuff, I kind of worry that they don't really have like a point that they're trying to make, you know? Mm-hmm. They're just kind of like spewing out what their courses were.
Yeah, no, and especially if you're going for that entry level position, like you're not going to be the master technical resource for everyone because other people are more senior than you.
Right.
Like, you're not the person everyone goes to for advice. You're just another person on the team, like kicking ass, taking names. That's totally fine. But I agree that you should go in and sort of tell the organization what you could provide it without a laundry list of everything that you've ever worked with in your undergrad degree or something like that.
Yep.
Error number five, overestimating the value of academic degrees. I feel like we both agree that's true.
I love it. Yeah.
Number six, searching too narrowly. So this is the idea that when you search for a data science job, you like just search for the word data scientist. I really like this because I think a lot of companies they want to use their data. They know this thing around data science, but some people call it AI and some people call it machine learning, and companies don't actually know what to call it. So they might call you a software engineer or a machine learning engineer or a data scientist or a data engineer, and they don't really know the sort of terminology of the field, which is still very new. And so I agree. Search shirts widely when you're looking for stuff, because you might find something that has a really benign title but in fact it's actually like the perfect position, and it is a lot of the things where you could bring your skill set towards.
Yeah, and you might be able to teach them that a data scientist would be a cool person for that role or for that problem. You know, they might not even be thinking like data science.
Yeah, no, totally. Mistake number 7, being unprepared to discuss projects. I really like this, because I think the best thing you could do when you're going into any kind of interview, whether it's a technical interview or any job interview, is have some preset questions that you know your answer to. Right there, you're like safety zone, that when you sort of get in trouble, you can bring them out and you can talk about things and you're comfortable talking about it because you've prepared for it. And one of the questions that you're probably going to get, that everyone always seems to get, is something where they want you to talk about your favorite project that you worked on, or the project that you could talk most about, or something, the project where you provided a lot of value. They always wanted you to talk about some kind of project. And if this is perfect, if you've prepared for this, because you can have your whole sort of story worked out. And then as soon as they ask you about a project, you can just kind of go into your story and say this really nice prepared answer where you sound like a genius.
Right. I mean, the other thing is they don't always know, especially if you're starting out, know how you are in group settings, or if you know how you work with other people. So the project is an opportunity to talk about that too, not just the technical side of things, but also the interpersonal, how you've been able to maybe bring leadership to a particular project that needed it, or you were able to help bridge things or solve problems, etc. Like, it's a really interesting way to highlight certain things that they didn't necessarily ask you, but you want to communicate.
Yeah, no, totally. Mistake number 8, underestimating the value of domain knowledge. This is the idea that, you say you've been in a specific industry like oil and gas before you went into data science. Like, that is actually valuable stuff that you can use. So, yes, I know machine learning, but then I also am part of the oil and gas industry, which is very similar to the fossil fuel or whatever, the coal industry or something like that. And I think this is very true, because over and over again, I have being valuable to organizations because I have social science skill. And it was because the organization was looking for someone with social science skill as opposed to something else. And that means that other jobs I'm less qualified for, like, for example, I don't know anything about biology. But when it comes to things like social science and people and that kind of stuff, I have a lot of experience around, and I can parlay that and make them feel comfortable about hiring me into this role because I'm not a total novice to this thing, which I would be if we were doing gene splicing, which I don't really know what that means.
Well, the other thing is that then you actually look interesting compared to the other person who also came out of your same like coding school. You know, like, that's what makes everybody so interesting and dynamic and diverse in this whole world of data science, is the backgrounds that we come to it with.
No, totally. All right, last mistake according to Elite Data Science: neglecting communication skills. And this is that I agree. I think there's a lot of people who are really good at data science who aren't very good at talking and being sort of social. And I feel like one of the things I have definitely provided to organizations is being the bridge, where I'm very comfortable, because I come out of academia, I'm very comfortable with incredibly awkward people who are super nice, but they're very shy and introverted and that kind of stuff. And I think I can do a nice bridge between them and the extroverted sales team. And, if you have, communication is a skill just like any other skill. And so if you have that, if you have that, you should highlight it. If you don't have that, I get it. Like, bring it up. I think that's totally fine advice.
I love it. I actually was surprised. I'm pretty impressed with this. Like, I thought it would be one of those things that are obvious, don't be a jerk, don't be racist, etc.
Well, to the listener, this is sort of an experiment that we're doing where we wanted to provide more advice, but giving it in the form of an article. And so we're not really ragging on the article. We're talking about what we think of, these, in this case, advice for people getting hired. And if you think that this was useful and you want us to do it more in the future, hit us up on Twitter, on Twitter, iTunes, or email, and tell us if that was really stupid, or that was actually useful that you came out with it with something more.
Okay, is it my turn?
It is your turn.
So my story is like got a lot of a little back history to it.
Oh, I like
this. A lot of a lot, little. That doesn't even make sense. A lot of a back history. Ready for it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so a couple of days ago, I got this question from a random checkout lady at the grocery store. And she asks me, where are you from? I mean, okay, this isn't new for people who are, you know, look like they're not the typical American. I don't even know what a typical American looks like, but
white. That's what they're saying.
Right. That's what they're saying.
They're saying you're not white.
That's basically what they're saying. So let's just let that sink in, right? Like, let's imagine that you are out on your average weekend getting groceries and prepping for the week, and you're getting groceries in a town that you've lived in for over a year, like the same grocery store you visited at least 50 times. And it's not a big town. Like, there's one grocery store. And the checkout lady asks you, where are you from? Like, what does that feel like to people? I wonder if people... how many people get this kind of a question? I get it pretty frequently, and I think it's really complex.
Never gotten that question, which is probably super telling.
I wonder why. So it's really complex, and it's complex for me because it just opens up a whole can of worms. Because I know the lady wasn't asking me like what street I lived on, and as an American, and as a parent, as someone whose parents immigrated from India, and as a person who's lived and worked and called so many different places home, like around the world, it's really hard for me to answer that question. And also, of course, slightly unsettling for me to ponder. Because right off the bat, it assumes that I'm not from here.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, where are you from means that you aren't from here. You must be from somewhere else. And where is that other somewhere else place? And what do they mean by, you know, here? If I'm not from here, what does here mean? Earth? Because... like, it's confusing. Like, do you mean America? Do you mean this town? Do you mean, you know, I don't know where their reference point is. So I can answer that I'm from Earth. Where are you from? You know, I can have that kind of an attitude. But it just confuses me, and I never know how to answer it. And it also makes me wonder about my Indian, well, more like South Indian, no, actually more like Andhra Pradeshian or even Hyderabadian or Telugu heritage. And all of these words are basically... you know, scoping down the specific region of India that my family is from. And it makes me wonder about my life as an American living in rural America, right? Like, according to everyone in my family, though, we were and have always been South Indian, Andhra Pradeshian, Telugu people. Like, 100%, that's what we are. And it's never felt that way because, you know, I grew up in California and in the Bay Area and have friends from all over America. I mean, it just doesn't relate. And I'm sure lots of immigrants and other children of immigrants can relate to this, like feeling like the outsider in your country that you've immigrated from, and then also feeling like an outsider in the new country that you call home. So there's this like middle space where I feel oftentimes more confusing. So it's just there's just a lot here. And I've faced prejudice both hurtful and embarrassingly helpful in different situations regarding my genetic mix, right? Like, it's kind of hard to admit, but like, sure, so there's some positive experiences I've had because people have been racist. It's weird. And it's made me feel pretty gross in both situations, like either positive and negative. So when this lady asked me where I'm from, like, I really had nothing to say, but also everything to say. Like, I can't give her this whole diatribe.
You just put down your groceries. You're like, all right, here we go.
I was like, okay, well, let's go get a cup of coffee. This is going to take a while. So it was just, but it is one of those commonplace questions that people all over the world ask strangers in order to really befriend them. Right? It's a question that can bridge chasms between strangers. I've been asked that, like, walking down the street in some random part of Costa Rica because they want to know where I'm coming from and where I'm going so they can feel safer.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it throws me off so much. So I did what any normal data geek does, and I spent 10 minutes spitting into a tube.
Wow, that took a left turn right there.
To get my DNA analyzed.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is where we're going to secretly find out that you're French,
right,
or something.
Where am I from? What lady you want to know? I want to know too. Let's get to this. So I was really hoping that the machines and humans at 23andMe, which was the thing that I used, would conclude that, yes, I was partly for sure from India, you know, South India, partly from a bunch of really other exciting places around the world, and that I was definitely not 100% sourced from Telugu, Andhra Pradesh, South India.
Sourced.
I was really hoping to, like, run to my family and be like, see ha, we're like people of the world. We're not this 100% South Indian thing. So my results came back and my DNA is, ready, 99.8%, wait for it, South Asian. That's as specific. What does that mean? It's like, that doesn't even get as specific as the country of India. I know. I mean, South Asia is like a large area of the world with tons of countries in there. Like, there's no specificity to that result. And it doesn't narrow anything down. So my friends who are of general European ancestry had their results that are like super specific to tiny unknown European countries.
It's like northern France and you're like,
seriously,
South Asia.
What is that? So I was like, oh, this is a classic data science problem. They don't have enough data in their database from South Asian people to like to reference. So it's just a broad, I don't want to say brown, but broad South Asian. Then I would be. Anyway, so this is the backstory and we've set the context. And I ran into this article today in the BBC that promises that this problem, this data science problem, is on its way to getting solved.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm excited because, okay, so they say that, this is a quote, that although the subcontinent of India contributes around 20% of the world's population, there's a lot of us, the DNA sequences of its people make up around 2%, no, 0.2% of global genetic databases. See? That's why.
That's probably exactly why.
That's totally why. Like, it just, I was like, oh, there, I knew it. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Crazy,
wow.
Right?
That's
right.
That's insane. 0.2%.
Yes.
Wow.
Like, we're just, no one knows. Oh, ha, ha. Okay. So in a similar vein, 81% of the world's genomic information, 81% has been collected from people with European ancestry. Isn't that lovely? There's just more data. I mean, I don't feel badly about it, really. I just find that that's kind of expected in a weird way. Still, it's an improvement from a staggering 96% back in 2009. 96% of data about ancestry was like, because you know how people do these like fun, really fun things where they, you know, search on like ancestry.com about their last name and they get all this awesome data about like, you know, there's some
right,
cool
like back to 1422
yeah.
or something like that.
Like
yeah.
Some clan fought some other clan, like all this awesome detail. And like, there's no way that would ever happen for my last name. Like, no one knows. Right? And so, I mean, even like a last name like Harris, something like that would have a lot more information than something as weird as my last name. So I was really excited to hear about this company called Global Gene Corp, which sounds like it's out of like a, I don't know, Superman movie, right?
Like they have an
like,
evil that like, yeah. There's like a tropical island with their massive skyscraper. Seriously. With like a, it's all dark.
I know, but and guess what they do? They map worldwide genetic diversity.
Oh, that's
so
cool.
Yeah. And so what their angle is, which I love, is that they're trying to get more data to develop more effective personalized medicine therapies. So that it's more medical interventions are more specifically tailored to an individual's genetic makeup. And I mean, the promise of precision medicine can't really be delivered without, you know, with 20% of the world's population kind of missing from the database.
Yeah.
And so they're basically going around and gathering and analyzing genetic data from India, and other organizations are applying that same focus to other data dark countries in South America and Africa and Asia. So I think that the problem is on its way to being solved. But I also just felt like, oh, there's something really simple and familiar about this particular problem. Like, oh, not enough data. You know, like how many times, right? I just thought that was kind of, I don't know, oddly interesting. And also, what's also cool is that my DNA was 99.8%. So what's the other 0.02%? Wait for it. It's Scandinavian.
Wow. What? You have one Scandinavian. I mean, probably, I'm assuming one Scandinavian ancestor at some point.
Well, it was between the 1400s and the 1600s.
Oh, that's a small amount of time. That really narrows it down.
200 years, yeah. And I mean, and my family was like gasping, like, no, it can't be. We are like totally 100%. Who is this, you know, person that got into the family line. Well, India's obviously had its share of invaders from, like, I wouldn't, maybe I should call them colonists. I don't know what they're called, but they're from all over.
No, invaders works. That works.
Yeah, invaders. That's what they are. And so there's, like, lots of genetic mixing because of that. So, of course, we would have, you know, some non-Indian part of us, but nobody could recollect Scandinavians as an invader at all. Like, it was, we were just trying to, like, research it, and we didn't see any kind of big invasion thing. And I did some research, and I found the best title of an article called India's Scandinavian Secret.
You have been, like, on a journey, like a journey of self-discovery. It's all coming together.
Right. I mean, the lady just asked me where I'm from. I obviously have no answers, really. Because I could say, okay, where am I from? Well, my DNA is mostly Southern Asia. Just don't ask me exactly where generally that is. And the rest of me is from here, you know, United States of America. Happy 4th of July. Happy America.
Yeah, I mean, one, what is so crazy about this is that you are a first generation American because your parents are Indian, and then they moved here, and then you grew up here, right?
Yeah, but I'm first generation because I was born in India.
Oh, okay. So that would make me...
I'm the originator.
You're the zero.
My kids would be, yeah.
Right, exactly. Right. So I'm first generation American. My parents are Zimbabwean, and no one has ever asked me ever anything about anything related to, like, where are you from, like, yeah. Just the whole thing. I have been,
can, like, you can you, like, I feel like we should, like, start a movement where we start asking everybody that. Wash it all out with more of these things. How would you answer that exactly?
If someone asked where I was from, I'd be, yeah, like, I'd honestly, like, this is where my total privilege goes through, is I would just be like, I'm from California, and they'd be like, no, where are you from originally? I was like, Texas.
Right, the originally one is even more interesting, like, like, how original, like, how far back are we going?
Just say Scandinavia.
Yeah, I should. I think I'm gonna, that would be a good one. I don't know what I'll say. I'm just, like, confused.
No, but I love the idea. I mean, you have personally hit upon this pretty interesting part of data science, which comes along with sort of density of data, because on sort of very common cases, you have a lot of data density. So, you know, for anything, right? So if you have, say, anything that happens a lot, people typically take a lot of data on. So, for example, in this gene thing, they probably were, you know, there's a bunch of white people who are starting this company, and they were like, oh, we should go get genetic data, and then they all flew to Europe and, like, collect this kind of stuff, whatever it was. But then there's these cases that don't have a lot of data on, and that means you can't get as specific predictions because you just don't have enough density in your data to do that. And as data science becomes more useful, or I guess more used and useful, I think there is this globalization part of it where collecting even basic data on more and more areas becomes really useful. So for the example that I really like is the idea of genderizing names. So if you have a European name, it is really easy to, like, a European first name, it's really easy to take that name and say, hey, that's, you know, like, that's probably a guy, that's probably a girl, that's probably a guy, that's probably a girl, like, that kind of stuff. And this kind of stuff is used a lot. Like, Twitter has a gender that it's assigned for you, like, based on what you say in your, you know, based your name and all that kind of stuff. It's sort of trying to guess what gender you are, so it can probably serve you better ads. But I've always wondered how this fails in areas, like, in as more and more areas of the world come on to things like Twitter. For example, in South Africa, there's, like, a lot of very basic names, but there's also names like, yeah, a person might have a first name of professor, or a first name of success, or doctor, and that doesn't mean they're a guy or a girl. It's sort of like a, you know, it's like a whatever, anybody could have that kind of name. And I always wondered how, yeah, and I always wondered how Twitter or anyone who uses the sort of genderization tools that are currently available, how they handle stuff like that, where it's not entirely clear, you know, like the genderization of names is less common.
Yeah, that's crazy. And I've actually experienced this myself, because my name is unisex also. There's men out there named Vidya, which is weird, but that's just weird to me. But also, there are, sometimes, like, in certain tech situations, oftentimes men have arrived at the scene before I have. So the databases will have filled up with an Avidya who's a male. And so, right. But yeah, I mean, I think it is totally awesome because like these levels of challenges are what's blocking. I mean, these are the things that are kind of in the way, the barriers for making services that are actually useful by most people in the world. Yeah. Let's not worry about like just local America. You know, you build your app and you test it out on your family and your friends and your local whatever. But like if you have your sites set higher than that and you want it to be adopted by people around the world, there's going to have to be a whole different set of bridges and roadblocks that you're going to have to cross.
Yeah, no. And
this is one of them.
I totally think so. I think the pool of problems that are solvable by someone in the Bay Area to solve someone in the Bay Area's problem is like really tightly sort of being solved right now. Where, you know, like it's been like decades of people sort of sitting around in a garage in Palo Alto thinking like, I wonder what other people in Palo Alto's problem is. You know, and like every so often there'll be a startup that comes on and it's sort of like so clearly something to, like, it's a problem right. that you would only have if you lived in like Chicago, the Bay Area, or right. New York. But I actually think that some of the greatest opportunities are ones that are outside of that, right? And mm-hmm. I'm not saying like it's not humanitarianism, it's not social good, it's the idea that the things that were built for Palo Alto probably don't apply to mm-hmm. You know, a large number of other places that have a lot of people and huge markets. And if you have any kind of knowledge of that because of your background, because of your educational experience, because of whatever, I would look there first before I tried to figure out how, you know, to solve something that was your problem as you sort of sit in the world of tech, which is a pretty nice, but a pretty, you know, small segment.
Totally agreed.
All right. That was the show for this week. If you like what you heard, rate and review us on iTunes. If you want to get in contact with us, you can leave a review on iTunes. You can email us, hello@partiallyderivative.com. You can talk to us on Twitter, @partiallyd. You can follow me on Twitter, @ChrisAlbin. You can follow Vid on Twitter, @Vid_Spandana. And you can follow Jonathan on Twitter, @JonathanMorgan. Have a great week, all.
Bye.
We'll be right back.